how well wine in a box keeps, so we really have to run through that box up there. Thank you. It keeps. Yeah. Maybe we won't bother to find out. Welcome to Margin Shift Presents. My name is Deborah Woodard, and it's my great pleasure to host this reading, MC this reading. Actually, Craig Hasegawa is going to introduce Peter Cully, and I'm going to introduce Craig. We have readings the last Friday of every month, except when it's not the last Friday, but usually it's the last Friday.
Thursday.
Well, yeah, Friday doesn't enter in at all, actually. Sorry about that. It's good I'm not the one on the outreach committee, so. Okay, last Thursday of every month. And if you'd like to be on our mailing list, just speak to Craig, and it shall be done. Our first reader is Craig Hasegawa, one of the founding members of Margin Shift. He is the author of the chapbook, The New Crustacean, 2007. His short stories have been published in Sal Mimeo and the Sienese Shredder, among other small press ventures. He is currently a member of Interrupture, a group of poets who create and perform poetry games. A new chapbook is forthcoming in the fall. Yay! He works as a librarian in the beautiful downtown Central Library, one of the gems of our city. He says he wants to be shipped out to one of the branches so he has more time to read. But in the meantime, you can find him there. And I received some fan mail for Craig. My email, that happens occasionally when I have readings coming up. I don't know where it comes from, but there it is. It's a neat trick to substitute understanding for knowledge and leave us happily dismayed with the result, but Craig Hasegawa pulls it off. Whether alluding to the ancient, arcane, or forgotten, obscure crustaceans, Arthur Schopenhauer, Ray Allen, or dropping us into a shifting tableau of what appears to be amusingly post-adolescent willfulness, what Hasegawa actually drops us into is a parallel universe. Taken sentence to sentence, his pieces almost sound like near transcriptions of lived reality, yet they quickly take on the stylized, beautiful thinness of a matte book, of a matte block minimalist box. They keep sounding familiar, keep coming at you, and leave you right there where they are. You just can't get around them. And then, finally, you don't want to. Please join me in welcoming Craig Hasegawa.
Thank you. That was really great. I feel post-adolescent, so thank you. Now I have words for it. To go wayless, to want nothing out of something. The population is everywhere. It plies me with its fingers. The sky is dull and dirty. A phone rings and I leap out of my skin. It falls to the floor. I bundle it up and go. In the waiting room, a woman with bloodless lips asks me what happened. I feel a little raw. What about you? Cooked, she says. I guess there can only be two ways about it. She gives me a look. No, any number of ways. A nurse calls her name. I watch her go. Then it's my turn. I sit on white butcher paper. Back again? The doctor booms through the door. Sorry. Never apologize. He takes the bundle from me, unfolds it, snaps it in the air like a sheet fresh from the wash, and spreads it on the counter. You ought to take better care of this. I thought it replaced itself every 15 years. Where'd you get that horse shit? The internet? Climb in. One leg at a time. Okay. Now the arms. Good. He pulls it tight around me as though I have lapels. There you go. Happens to the best of us. I get dressed and take the subway home, humming a Cole Porter tune. That was called XO. This one is called Same Could Be Said. Let me point out that I'm not always in perpetual motion. There are a number of way stations and safe houses I stop at. Some are businesses which I visit with such frequency that I'm greeted by name as I walk in the door. I never purchase anything. I've even been offered jobs as a clerk or stock person. I might enter a convenience store, be handed a broom, and start sweeping. On my way out, my cupped hands will be filled with shrill coins and soft linty bills. It never adds up to much, but couldn't the same be said of me? Nor do I want to give the impression that I'm without friends. It is true that there aren't many, but there are a few hand-wringing acquaintances whom I stop in on, sit on their couches or the edges of their beds, speak of the news, the arrogance of U.S. foreign policy, for example, but never what touches us personally. You must believe that, even if it isn't true. For the most part, I do a good job looking like I'm minding my own business. I used to smoke cigarettes, the cheapest I could find, not because I liked them. They tasted terrible, made me nauseous, but with a cigarette in hand, I had license to be where I don't belong. I still keep a pack at the ready, though I've since developed less toxic means of invisibility. Glance at a watch which has stopped working long ago, and tap a foot on the sidewalk, and you are pitiable. I used to look down like I had lost something. That approach came to a head one night as I leaned against an apartment building where some decent music was drifting out an open window. I hadn't heard the tune before, nor have I since. There was a modicum of foot traffic, so when someone passed me by, I made like I was looking for something I might have dropped on the ground. A young man approached me. He had horn-rimmed glasses, blue-green eyes, an emphatic jawline. I told him I lost my keys, which was not necessarily false. Of course, he couldn't find them. So he attempted to console me. I let him buy me a drink. It took me years to be rid of him. The hateful thing is that I enjoyed every second of it. It helps, I think, to dress down. While I admit to wearing only the silkiest of undergarments, I cover them in the least revealing, most banal fabrics and colors. Emphasis, you see, is on what I know to be the case. If I see someone trying to make eye contact with me, I have an entire arsenal of gestures to paralyze them. Glancing at my watch works just as well here. In this context, it shows boredom, purpose. I never, ever touch my hair, head, face, neck. Those gestures propose contact. If someone says something to me, I can grunt in the most unpleasant way. Not crudely or dismissively, because the exaggeration might cause intrigue. I compose an asthmatic sound, a hack that implies a medical impediment. You must understand that none of this is easy for me. My life has become more and more complicated. I am a public figure, but not in the sense of a politician or an artist. No matter what they tell you, these preoccupations seek legitimacy. How much they pursue this consolation depends on the credibility of the individual, which is always questionable. I, on the other hand, crave illegitimacy. Why else would I perjure myself? For a very brief period of time, I allowed myself to become accustomed to this environment. Unfortunately, there are witnesses. With persistence, I suppose one would be able to locate their names and addresses, though I urge you not to proceed with that line of action. Those individuals can testify to my using the word home, the prepositional phrase at ease, and the damning dictum, my city. How careless I was. I curse myself still. I became a colonial, broadening the boundary of my identity far beyond the edges of my skin and hair. How easy it was to fall into this pit of language. Words spoken without caution allow the speaker to possess everything, no matter how concrete or abstract. The fact that I still use language means that I've renounced less than I'd hoped to. Occasionally, I will see someone from my past on the street. I'll duck into the nearest doorway, for I cannot allow anyone to know me any longer. This isn't to say I harbor them ill will. On the contrary. A friend of mine only recently realized that she is allergic to royal jelly. I myself dote on it. She'd been suffering attacks and asked me to run a few errands while she was indisposed. The items on her detailed list proved harder to track down than a casual trip to the grocery store could accomplish. I canvassed two entire neighborhoods, both unfamiliar to me, rummaged through the shelves of any store that offered the slightest hint of relevance. Doubling back along a certain block, I saw someone whom I thought I recognized, an old acquaintance. Instinctively, I slipped into the nearest store. There, behind the counter, was a face from the past, the young man in horn rims. He didn't seem to recognize me at first, so I lurked in an aisle that blocked his view of me. I waited amidst an assortment of teas. Staring me in the face was the obscure tea in my friend's shopping list, the very blend and brand. I knew that if I did not purchase it then and there, I'd never find it again. Quickly, I searched through my handbag, applied makeup, and donned a pair of reading glasses. I snatched the tea, and forcing my heart to beat slower, made my way to the counter. In walked the old acquaintance. I was sandwiched. Calmly, I took out my wallet and gave Hornrim's exact change. He gazed at me wonderingly. Then behind me, the OA spoke my name. B? I'm sorry, I replied without turning around. You're mistaking me for someone else. I'll never know if my words hurt him. I brushed against him as I turned and walked briskly out the door, clutching the tea, leaving my receipt in the outstretched hand of Hornrim's. I returned at once to my sick friend. I unpacked each item one at a time. She was grateful, but weak. I ran a bath for her, adding some salts, and helped her undress and climb into the tub. Afterward, I dried her off and put her to bed. Repetition is how we understand things. Understanding is often mistaken for knowledge, which in turn is mistaken for truth, a concept I strive to avoid at all costs. It is among the most manipulative devices of language. What dismays me most is how often I've employed it, often enough with a zealousness bordering on fanaticism. And so I must persist without any sense of rhythm or pattern.